Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar that will shed some light and talk about how to tailor your collection strategy for different generations. Trying to use the same script or letter, whether collecting from a baby boomer or a millennial, can make it difficult to collect from either. More agencies are developing customized scripts and messages to better connect with individuals, and I'm excited to be part of that discussion today. This webinar is being generously sponsored by MicroBuild. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know profile, as well as hosts webinars like this and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Sophie Benbenek is the head of data science at TrueAccord, a fintech startup working to reimagine debt collection for the customer-focused digital age. Sophie developed and designed TrueAccord's machine learning-based decision engine and now oversees TrueAccord's data initiatives across the country. Her analysis on internet usage trends in China earned her honors from the University of Chicago, where she holds a BA in political science and East Asian studies. Michael DiCarpio is the director of collections at RevSolve, a collection agency based in Scottsdale, Arizona, that focuses on the medical and healthcare markets. Mike has been with RevSolve for the past 4 years. Prior to that, he spent 20 years working at Amcall Systems as the Director of Recovery Services and Vice President of Operations. Mike's core focus has been staff development and motivation, and the paramount piece of that has been identifying the right people up front. Brian Watkins began in the collection industry, as a salesperson for Southern Oregon Credit Service in 1990. In 2001, Brian and his wife Denise purchased the company when the original owners wanted to retire. Brian has twice served as president of the Oregon Collectors Association, has served on the legislative committee for his state unit since 1997, and currently is chairman. He has twice earned the Unit Leader of the Year award from ACA International. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by me. We encourage you to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Also, today's webinar is an audio-only event. A recording of the webinar will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. And first, what I'd like to do is go around sort of the room, as I put in air quotes, and I'll get each of the panelists to sort of share how they segment it, maybe talk about how they segment individuals into different generational or different categories. And Sophie, I want to start with you, please.
Sure. So it is really important for me to start out with one big disclaimer, as we are a data-driven company. So age is a protected class, and we do not use that information in any part of our decisioning system. On a higher level, though, we like to think about treating the problem at TrueAccord instead of kind of extrapolating the problem from stereotypes. So there was an interesting article in the Collector magazine from March that talked about generations. And one of the big things they talked about is kind of how do you reach customers of different generations? And I would kind of translate that into technology savviness. And that's kind of how we think about it. We really live in a digital age. It's part of 21st century life. It's not just the people born into it. And we actually did a recent customer survey to kind of prove our hypothesis about digital channels work for all age groups. And we found that more than 50% of customers who use our digital-oriented channel are actually in the 50-plus age group. So, to summarize, we do not really use generational categories, but try and break it down into the actual subsets we're really trying to get at there, like technology savviness.
Excellent. Thanks. Mike, what about you?
We don't actually segregate our inventories or our staffing based off of the generations. What we actually do is just try to educate them on the perspectives that each generation holds so that they can communicate better with each generation. Kind of hit on the tick marks of understanding them a little bit better so they can communicate, you know, what, you know, each generation has different manners in which they leverage their credit and how they obtain extra cash. And so we try to hit on those things and teach them those things.
Great, thanks. And Brian?
In our company, we, like a lot of collection agencies, got built with healthcare, and that's always been a large section of our work. And because of that, that's typically going to be your older generations. So getting too far into the weeds to try and deal with your 20-somethings when most of the work you have in that segment isn't really there. So we haven't really pursued very much on that side. However, the next largest group of business that we work for is community colleges, and we also do a lot of like municipal and court work. And so in that side of our work, we've definitely seen the technology, as Sophie said, that savviness come into play. And so we've tried to implement some tools that will make it easier for them, for that demographic that we deal with, to be able to pay their bill. Because typically, just the cliches of the younger people, we have found to be very true. They don't want to talk to you. By and large, they want to text you or they want to communicate without having to talk to you. They want to just get on the phone and pay with their phone and not have to talk to people. So you have to develop a portal so people can do that. So we host our own pay sites, and we've built in a couple of functions that have really shown themselves to be beneficial when dealing with folks that are these the consumers for the colleges or the courts, the younger folks. We built in a chat function. And so what we've noticed is that about 80% of the people who hit our pay site don't actually make a payment. But we can tell what they're doing is that they're looking for information. They're trying to find out who they owe. And then what we find out is that a significant amount of those people will come back and either call us and pay, or they'll come back to the website and pay it in full, as opposed to making payments. Whereas on our healthcare side, we definitely have seen, a desire to break people down into a payment structure. You got to work payments with them over a period of time, et cetera. And you just don't have those conversations with younger people on their school bills or their court fines. They don't even think they can make payments to it. So we're seeing that you don't necessarily need people. You need technology that they can access. So mobile-ready technology, we've been able to put our website so that they can look at them on their phone and make payments from their phone. So those are the types of things that we've done. It's not necessarily age-driven, but it's more driven by the clients that we work for and who their consumers are.
Excellent. Just to follow up, so what you were talking about with the chat side, the chat functionality, that's more on the student side, is that right?
Well, we put it on our pay site for everybody to access, but what we're seeing is that not a lot of people take advantage of the chat function, which I was a little bit surprised at. We've had it for about 2 years now on our pay sites, and I really thought that we would have this overwhelming flood of people wanting to click on that, chat with someone now. And we really haven't seen that. What we do see is that people are able to find their account information themselves. And so we know, for example, that like I said, about 80% of the people going to the website are actually not paying the first time they go. They're getting information. So clearly they've gotten a letter from us. They've seen on that letter that they can go to the website and find out information, and that's what they're doing. So they're looking at who they owe, how much they owe. And then what we're finding, especially on the community college side, is that at some point in the future, they will come back and pay the whole thing off. So what we're seeing is that they don't ever even call in to talk to anybody. They get the information themselves. This is especially our community college consumer, those students, we really see that as their habit. The other habit we've seen in the last 2 weeks is that their mom calls when they have questions. So if they can't figure stuff out themselves, and we just onboarded a new community college, and so we've got thousands of new records in there, and literally I think we've had just as many parents call us as we've had students call us. And so that's the other thing that we're seeing with people in their 20s for these community college debts in particular, is that if they can't figure it out themselves, that's when they might either just continue to ignore us, they might call, or they might have their mom call. So those are kind of unique things that we're experiencing with people in their 20s right now.
Very interesting. Just a reminder for those who may have not been here at the start, this is an audio-only event. There are no slides, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing out on anything. So we've talked, Brian brought up the issue of sort of the type of debt or the amount of debt influencing how the communication is impacted. Mike, let me come back to you. Is that something you see as well?
Yeah, we also have chat, and like Brian said, I mean, we may get four or five actual connections through chat through our organization. So there's not a lot of actions going through chat, just like Brian. We felt like that would be like, boom, it was going to be a huge method of communication with people. It just hasn't turned out to be that way. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Sophie?
Yeah, so we're a machine learning based system, so the debt type and the amount are really important features for us. We've especially found that the debt type is a really important feature for us in terms of types of communication. Different types of debt need really different descriptions. A lot of time what we find is there's a lot of confusion around why people are in debt in the first place, especially in things like DDA accounts or debt buyers especially. And tailoring our content to speak to those needs has increased engagement from 15 to 30%, especially on that debt buyer segment. Payment offers are obviously a huge thing that we also look at debt type and amount as well. We're a solely digital system, so only about 2% of customers on our platform ever speak to an agent via email, calls, whatever. So we really have to think carefully about the types of offers we put in front of people. I think Brian was talking about how customers get to the website and then they drop off. So our job, since we don't really want them to interact with the person, is to make sure that we're capturing that intent really well. About 90% of customers on our platform pay via payment plan. So this doesn't just stop with the initial commitment, but this is an ongoing communication.
Okay. At this point, I want to stop for a minute and talk a little bit about today's sponsor, Microbuilt. For more than 35 years, Microbuilt has been helping businesses assess and manage risk. They were a pioneer in the now exploding alternative credit data space, and as such have refined their products and services to deliver true business value. Over the years, Microbuilt has invested heavily in acquiring best-in-class data. They've built sophisticated systems for keeping data fresh and accurate, and powerful predictive models for making decisions around lending, leasing, collections, and risk management. With Microbuilt, you can customize the products you need and how much you want to spend. And with all of its products are provided through a single, simple access portal. Whether you're working in originations or debt collections, screening a potential hire or tenant, planning for growth, or keeping up with regulatory requirements, Microbuilt can be your partner, providing the insight and information you need to protect your business, grow your bottom line, and keep your company running smoothly. For more information, please contact Microbuilt at 1-800-884-4747 or visit www.microbuilt.com, and that's spelled MICROBILT, microbuilt.com. Thanks to them for sponsoring today's webinar. And with that, let's get back to our discussion. So Mike, I want to ask you, can you determine or do you know, or is there a difference in recovery rates based on tailoring your message to individuals either from different generations or different types of debt? Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, as far as the results, I really don't have the data to quantify, you know, whether the results are successful. I can just look at the overall numbers and tell that we've had some progressive lifts on all of our platforms. You know, when you presented this webinar, it actually kind of triggered some thoughts for me to sit down and say, you know, we really do need to do a little bit better analysis on our end to determine, you know, which generational gap is, or which generational group is actually paying and liquidating at what rates, what's the average payments, what are we seeing as far as trends? And that's just something I've not done, but I'm definitely probably going to do going forward because of this, you know, you introducing this topic to us. So I can't speak in terms of the specifics on liquidation between each generation, what their average payments are, you know, what the success rates that we're having. Our plan is to just basically overall, you know, shotgun approach. How can we communicate with as many people as positively as possible to generate the best results.
Okay. What about you, Brian? Do you notice any difference in recovery rates?
Again, I think kind of like Mike, we don't segment by age of payer. We do have average ages attached to different client bases and as well as industries. So where we know, like in healthcare, hospital, for example, we know our average age is in the mid-40s for our typical consumer. Our community college, our average age is in the high 20s, around 27, 28. Our court work that we do, the average age is around 36, 36 and a half, I think is the last time we looked at that. And then we can look and see how do we liquidate each one of those industries. But it's not an apples to apples thing. But right. What we do with that information is that we know going in that each one of these types of segments requires or may require a little bit of a different approach. One thing, because you're dealing with a different aged person, obviously, but the other thing is the type of debt is just different. And working healthcare debt today is so different than it was 10 years ago. And not only that, but if you were doing financial work, credit card work or charge accounts, revolving, something like that, I think then I would definitely want to look at my entire demographic across the board. But because we don't do that type of work necessarily, it's a lot easier to look at it for us and say, we know that this segment of business we have is going to have this type of person in it. So let's make sure that we can, give them every opportunity to pay in the way that they want. You know, we live in a fairly small town, I guess, and our geographic area is a pretty good imprint. And we still deal with a ton of walk-in and cash payments. Of course, being in Oregon, there's a lot of cash crops these days. And so we have a lot of cash payments, especially around harvest time in October. That's about the only good thing that's come of that for me. That's one thing. But these folks are not going to pay. And so you talk about a younger demographic. So in Oregon, we have a lot of 20-somethings who will pay their bills in cash. Because that's the industry that they're working in here. Well, the only way to do that is to have a building. And so the brick and mortar function is still here. We have branch offices in these little towns around Southern Oregon. We have two branch offices. And the amount of walk-in payments that we get with cash in their hand is still fairly significant. It still pays to have it. And I know the theory there is, well, we can do our job anywhere, and if we just make them get electronic based, or they can call in and get it taken care of. Well, these are folks that are not, they're not on the system. They're not on the, anywhere to be found, but if you can find them, they will come in and they'll pay. And so one of the strange things that's happening as the future evolves in front of us is that we still need brick and mortar, and we still get a lot of cash payments because of it. And that's with your younger generation primarily.
Yeah. So just to clarify, we're 100% medical in what we do.
Are you seeing a lot of, does that mean you don't really see a lot of cash payments compared to what Brian's seeing?
No, probably not to the degree that Brian's seeing it. Just from the approach that we have and how we communicate, it's because we are 100% medical. Brian's got different lines of businesses that do require different approaches towards those. So ours is probably better to be tailored to a single line of business in terms of, you know, what we look at and how we see things. So just,
and what about cash payments at TrueAccord? Is that something you take on any level or in any meaningful quantity, Sophie?
No, it's definitely not something we handle on a regular basis. I think Brian actually raised a really interesting question about generational differences as well, because it sounds like what you're saying is a generation is a little bit of a red herring from a data feature perspective, because you're seeing younger generations who are totally non-digital, which is really counter to what a lot of people expect. And I think that's fascinating. And I think that's a really great reason about why at TrueAccord we really focus on the data-oriented approach, because it helps to kind of knock things like the gender idea or the generational idea out of the park, because a lot of times the stereotypes don't line up with reality.
It's really the truth. And I think, you know, we've, Oregon's had medicinal marijuana grow for about 7 years now as an industry. And we've done recreational now for 3 full years. And what we've seen is in the labor pool, for example, it is so difficult to hire a 20-something to a regular construction job or contractor job. It's almost impossible. And they're out there working on these places where they only have to work a couple months a year, and they walk out with thousands of dollars in 20s and hundreds in their pocket. And they all have cell phones. It's not that they aren't connected in some form, but they do not put their money in a bank. They do not even, you know, do internet banking. They are cash only. And we've got thousands, probably tens of thousands across the state of people that are like that. And they're all in that, you know, the younger demographic for the most part. So it's one of those things that I don't know how long that's going to continue. But for right now, it's very important to our business to have a door and a place for people to come in and hand us cash.
You know, from that standpoint, Brian, you know, one of the things that we recognize here is that, you know, obviously they're entering our workforce as well, you know, this age group. And it's hard for us because when we talk about solutions and we talk about, you know, how to present solutions for people, they don't understand and comprehend this to the same degree that everyone else has prior to them. And, you know, as I've communicated with some of our staff to figure out why that disconnect is there, I came to the realization that, you know, the Gen Y people, most people call them millennials, they went through the 2008 financial crisis from a different perspective that we all did. And so it had an impact on them, and it influenced their, you know, view of economics a lot differently than any of ours has ever been influenced. And so that's the same with the people that we're communicating with as we try to recover these monies as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Sophie, does your data show anything as far as the younger, you know, this group of people? What is their opinion of going through the Great Recession? Is it similar to what my grandparents went through the Great Depression? Are they going to have a lifelong impact of not trusting corporate America? I mean, I read articles about that frequently. Does your data show that that's sort of where a lot of this, you know, a good amount of that group is?
This is an interesting question. So we don't really store information about demographics in a way that we use regularly. So I don't have very good information to kind of answer some of your questions. But we're a purely digital strategy. And so, like I said before, only about 2% of our customers actually interact with an agent. So a lot of the information we're getting about our customers is going to be through how they interact with our system, how they look at different pages on our website, how they react to different types of payment offers, things like that. And we found pretty favorable results across all generations based on our customer surveys. I don't know if that just indicates that because we have all of this information, super self-serve, that this is reacting to some of the ideas that you guys are talking about, or if it just means it's not as relevant.
It's interesting. Let me take this from 180 degrees, from the opposite, the other angle now. And we've talked about how maybe, you know, we're not looking at age because it's a class issue and protected classes, and we're worried about that. But what about from the age of a collector? Do you look at how you sort of allocate your workforce when determining either the type of debt or the type of individual that's going to be contacted? Is that something that you're looking at? And Brian, I'll start with you this time.
You know, we have not done that. And to be just brutally honest here, I cannot be picky about getting someone in the door that wants to work. So I would love to be able to say, hey, let's segment our collectors, demographically, so that I've got people under 30 talking to my community college student group, for example. But, you know, the last two collectors we hired, or two of the last three collectors we hired, are in their 50s. The one we just hired is in his 20s. And honestly, just getting anybody in the door, I'm happy with. So beggars with labor can't be choosers. And so So we just continue to work the way we always have, which is here's your pool, here's your desk, here's the accounts that you work, here's the people you talk to. And for us, it stratifies across all industries and all groups.
What about you, Mike?
You know, I would love to be large enough to be able to stratify our strategies in that way. We just don't have the volume of collectors to be able to do that. It's one of the things that I've wanted to actually explore as we've grown is at what point do we have such a diversity and such a volume that where it doesn't water down our work strategies and our work plans. We just don't have the groupings that we can actually do that just because we don't have the number of collectors. But I would love to be able to sit down and segment my inventories out to match them up with the personalities and the age groups of the collectors. So just, to me, it's always been fascinating. I just haven't been able to practically get it done. It's a wish list thing.
Mike, we did a webinar a few months back on hiring.
Yes.
And one of the things you mentioned there was when it came to crafting your ads, you looked at, you know, you had maybe sort of your younger people looking at, you know, looking over the ads before you sent them out or before you posted them to kind of for language. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that for a second?
Yeah. So what we did is we did not have a lot of millennials in our workforce at the time. It was mostly Gen X's that were doing our work. And as I think, as everyone knows, there's just that friction that exists between Gen X and the millennials where they don't understand each other. So we actually did have a couple of millennials in our team, and we asked them to actually help us rewrite our ad that attracted more millennials into our workforce, because as we go through each year, the millennials are going to be the largest generation that exists in all of, you know, in all of our workforce, our consumer base, and everywhere else. It's just the largest generation that's out there right now. So we wanted to attract them. So we had them, you know, kind of craft it to attract, you know, from their perspective, you know, what makes our organization look attractive and bring them in and attract them. And it's actually been very successful. It's almost been too successful. Now we need to kind of cater it back because we need to be multi-generational if we're going to be successful overall in collecting money.
Can you give an example of maybe, you know, the types of language or the types of or the way in which that is being where it's being put up
absolutely. So, you know, our ads were just mostly like everyone else's, where we had bullet points of what the job entailed. What they actually came in is it needed to be more descriptive. It needed to be more characteristic of each of those tasks rather than just bullet point to the, you know, get to the point. We softened it up to actually offer a little bit more language to characterize what each bullet point actually meant in terms of how they can process it and feel better about it.
Got it. Thanks. Sophie, I know you've said that, you know, you're not looking at it from an age, you're looking at it from a sort of almost sort of a call and response in terms of how the individuals you're contacting or attempting to contact react. Can you maybe give some insight or some examples into how all of that data kind of gets categorized or gets segmented or gets, you know, maybe even applied in terms of a collection strategy?
Sure. Let's see. The whole meat of our industry here, so let me give a whack at it. So basically, we try and respond to what the customer is telling us, either explicitly through information they've provided via actual contacts with our agent or forms on our website, or more commonly, we infer it from how they're interacting with our system. So for example, we can usually tell within 2 weeks to 30 days what channel is going to be the best approach for these consumers based on how they've responded to the emails we send. So for example, if they open content, what content they open, if they click on content, how they interact with our web pages, do they start filling out forms? All of that information gets kind of bubbled up into individual pieces of our Heartbeat decision engine. So more concretely, I think one of the Q&A questions was about debt type. So for example, debt buyers. We know that a lot of times customers are really, really confused at what has happened to their debt. So one thing we do is we have special targeted content in our system. And our machine learning algorithms are able to kind of make the connection between this is a debt that's a, from a debt buyer. We need to send this type of content because this is going to be what they react to. And after we introduced that, we saw 15 to 30% increased engagement. And from there, once they interact with the website, we'll kind of see what payment offers attract them and what don't. And we can use that to start iterating and kind of do a dynamic negotiation strategy with the offers that they have available. Does that answer your question? Are there specific things I can touch on more?
No, that's great. Thanks. Just looking to sort of, you know, kind of maybe sort of reframe the conversation a little bit, since maybe generational isn't the best way to approach the conversation. But I do think that there's a segmentation or categorization that in terms of sort of analyzing data that would, you know, that, that a lot of people are either starting to do or are looking to do. And I think maybe that's an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah. One of the most important kind of segmentations we do is engagement level. We're a digital oriented platform. We use multiple different channels, but it all kind of breaks down because we have so much more data. We can classify customers really easily into engagement level, kind of break apart the passive engagement from active consideration to that on the verge of commitment level. And that's really how we target our strategies.
Interesting. Collector Magazine published an article, I think it was in its March issue, on this topic of collecting from for different generations. And I happened to come across it the other day, and there was something interesting in there that I just kind of wanted to read and maybe sort of get a sense for whether or not anybody agrees or disagrees with this. And it says, using traditional methods to collect from Gen Xers and millennials often will not lead to desired results, either payment in full or even a partial payment. When dealing with tech-savvy consumers who only want to communicate through the same technologies that potentially create compliance issues for collectors, there needs to be an increased emphasis on ensuring that clear communications are established for generational consumers and that collectors fully explain the need to obtain permissions necessary to conduct business. Is that a dynamic that you that you're seeing or here or engaging in? And Mike, I'll start with you first.
Yeah, there's some truth to that, but no, we're not seeing to the degree that they're describing it in Collector Magazine. You know, our connection rates haven't decreased over the years. Matter of fact, they've probably gotten better. You know, the thing about the Gen Ys is that they still communicate with the Gen Xs and the traditionalists, or the baby boomers, because those are the parents and the grandparents, and that's their methodology of communicating. You know, one interesting thing that I actually had a conversation with a Gen Y that was actually starting to study the next generation, which is the Linkster generation. So I think in the next 10 years, yeah, we will face that. It will be an issue because I think that generation is going to be the one that has the connectivity issues if we don't modernize our approach. Part of the problem that we have, though, is we have a government that doesn't allow us to do some of the things that we'd like to be able to do to the degree we would to communicate with people. So hopefully in that period, by the time this next generation comes into our consumer base, we will be prepared to deal with them a little bit better. But as of today, no, I don't agree with that commentary.
What about you, Brian? Do you think that this is maybe a problem that's on the horizon right now, but maybe necessarily isn't one that the collection industry really kind of needs to address immediately?
It's a good question, and I think it's people, and maybe it's just from my own experience, I haven't seen that that's a problem. I agree with Mike. I think our connectivity rate is actually better now than it was, especially when caller ID came out. I think one of the biggest changes with communicating with people, particularly younger people, is that leaving a voicemail message. There's been so much discussion over what message to leave, what message not to leave. Of course, the litigation in the industry is, I'm sure everybody's really familiar with it. But I recommend to everybody, if you haven't tried this, to do a campaign where you don't leave a voicemail. And then also make sure that your callback number looks like a business number. from everything that I've seen is that is really, and in our experience is this as well. We have our name, a registered business name that goes out in the ID. We have the number that comes back to our office. You know, when people first started trying to figure out how do I get people to call, and caller ID was a big thing, what was happening was that, you know, mom and dad are sitting around the dinner table and you're calling at 6 o'clock at night. And so caller ID says, Southern Oregon Credit Service is calling. And so we're not going to pick up the phone. And so collectors started to get a little bit more ingenious about trying to have something on there by not having a name or a different phone number, rotating local numbers on there. But for me, if I'm calling into the younger person, they've got a cell phone in their hand, they don't even listen to voicemail messages. All they do is say, okay, what's this number? And when they want to, they'll hit dial back and ask who it is. And so having that functionality has been so much better, much more comprehensive in getting people to return your calls. So we don't really focus on messaging at all anymore. Leaving messages is really, in my opinion, especially with millennials, is a total waste of time. But the caller ID function and getting the call out there definitely still drives contact and communication back to us. We did try one of those vendors that does the voicemail without calling the phone. And I have a couple friends who love it. So I don't want to say that this is the only experience. My experience with it, we actually tried this on our college group, and what we got was a lot of angry people saying, "How did you get this on my phone without calling me?" So instead of having a "Who is this?" return call, we started off on the wrong foot right away. So we have found that to be one of the issues too, is that they already understand that you shouldn't be able to get a voicemail message on your phone unless the phone rings. And so they're mad when, we got a lot of mad people calling about that. But really, the connectivity, I don't find that to be much of a problem. In fact, I think, like Mike, it's better now than it was 6, 7, 8 years ago. And it's primarily because we're not focused on leaving messages. We're focused on getting a good caller ID and a good callback.
Do you have any idea, insight as to why some of your, colleagues are having such a good experience with it and why yours maybe didn't match up?
It's an issue of capacity for us. We really don't need, and that's one of the main reasons we didn't go that direction, is that we really don't have a need for that. We're able to communicate with our current staffing levels and the way our business model works. So I think it's about broad geography. When you're dealing with a large area and people are used to not being in hometown America, where they can walk over and talk to the client and walk over and talk to the business, I think because we're still very much in that mode, even though we reach across the entire state, as we get into farther away places from our building and our hometown and our clients and that kind of stuff, I think it becomes much more important to be able to get people to call you back, even if they call back and they're not very happy. But for us, I think it's just still because of our footprint and who we work with is still, it doesn't go across a long, big area. Does that make sense? I don't know if I'm saying what
I'm
saying.
Yeah, that absolutely does. Mike, let's start with you, and let's start with your experience with voicemails and messages. Is that something you're still doing, or something maybe you're not doing as much of anymore, similar to how Brian's operating?
It's actually pretty similar to what Brian's operating. Back in 2015, when they came out with their interpretation of what the FTC should do, their interpretation of the TCPA regulations, we stopped delivering voicemails as well. So we don't do any messaging. We don't do message blasts like we used to. And quite frankly, it seems like it's actually encouraged people to contact us more because we don't bother them as much. Kind of like what Brian was saying. So I agree with Brian completely in what he was saying and his and how he sees things as well.
And what about with the ringless voicemail? Is that something you tried or something you consider trying?
We actually explored that. But in the test environment that we did, it wasn't 100% ringless. And whenever it did actually ring a phone and someone answered, it just dropped off and disconnected. So we felt that was more risky than it was something that we would want to pursue.
Got it. At TrueAccord, Sophie, from what I'm understanding, I'm sure you can confirm this or explain it if I'm not explaining it properly, but you let the consumer sort of dictate. I mean, you make the first, is it an email at first and then the consumer, the consumer sort of drives how the communication goes from there?
Yeah, that's a great description. And just to speak a little bit to kind of, I think, the initial high-level question, do we need to start thinking about digital communications in the modern age? It's great that you guys are still seeing good touch points, but on controlled tests between our platform and more traditional agencies, we do see 30 to 50% better on multiple different asset types. And I do think that speaks to the fact that the digital channel is a little bit more what the 21st century user is familiar with and comfortable with. We, for example, don't use voicemail. And yes, we really try and push the customer to reach out to us as opposed to having those, even the initial phone calls to get that call back. We find that outbound phone calls have maybe a 3% commitment rate, whereas inbound phone calls is more about 10%. And still the majority of those touch points are edge cases. Most people still do choose to pay via our digital platform without any agent interaction at all.
Do you look at the other emerging technology? I'll say emerging, but technologies maybe that the industry hasn't really sort of fully embraced yet, like texting or voicemail drops or email, sort of as the direction that the industry is heading, as long as the sort of the regulatory side can eventually catch up?
Yes, 100%. I mean, I think that's just the way the world is working nowadays. And if you go back to kind of traditional Darwinism, adapt or die. And I really do think that, even if you look at Facebook, that's a huge thing. It's only been around for maybe like 10 years, but already the newer generations aren't using it. Only about 15% of Facebook's users are actually in the like truly millennial category now. It's becoming an old person tool. And I think technology is like that. It's going to continue to move farther and farther in the future. And part of what we do at TrueCord is try to consistently meet the customer where they want to be met. And that means figuring out what channels they're using and how we can effectively contact them on those channels.
So does that mean that, there'll be like a way to connect with TrueCord on Musical.ly anytime soon then?
I'll have to keep you posted. It's not on my radar right now.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe sort of an overall strategy. Mike, do you use a different strategy, whether sort of, you're pushing payment in full or settlement or even a legal strategy based on, any different sort of segments within the types of portfolios you're collecting on?
Well, once again, we're 100% healthcare. And so, our strategy is that we want to educate our staff to apply some common sense when they're communicating with the different generations. Obviously, someone who's, in their 20s isn't going to have the means to take care of something to the degree that someone in their 40s may have. But we have to discover what those means are with each person. So our strategies, again, is more shotgun blast. It's the same strategy across the board with everything. And we just try to hit as much of the target as we can just through common sense.
Got it. What about you, Brian?
Our strategies like that are really a function of our client. So in healthcare, like Mike says, it's get whatever you can and don't make anybody mad. So that's sort of the plan, especially when you're working for hospitals. You get into the court work, in most cases, the court has the person's driver's license suspended. And so, if they want their driver's license released, a payment, a $25 payment plan on $1,000 isn't going to get it done. So we have a lot more leverage to be able to say, you're going to have to come up with the money a lot faster. We do have some settlement capabilities and early release of driver's licenses, things like that. So really the difference between the two types of things is a function of what the client dictates to us, what they're willing to do. And we just apply it to everybody equally.
That's an interesting topic I want to explore for a second, Brian. I'll come back to you. In terms of the interaction that you're having with the clients, are they looking at it from you know, from any kind of different segmentation, like we want you to do this with this group and X with this group and Y with this other group? Do they look at that, or do they let you sort of choose what strategy you think is best?
You know, if I were to have that conversation, I'm not sure any of my clients would do anything other than stare at me. I really don't think that they think that far about this stuff, which is fine because that's why they hire the professionals like us to handle that for them. You know, they're really interested. You know, 10 years ago, they were interested in one thing, and that's their money. And now most of them are interested in two things, and that is they want their money and they want the same amount or more, and they want you to not cause them any problems. They don't want any complaints. They don't want any calls coming to their office. So that is almost the extent of 99% of my conversations with our clients or when we're getting set up with a prospect. There is, and maybe I'm just unique that way, but we really have no conversations about, hey, what are you doing for the younger people? What are you doing for this? I mentioned we have pay sites. I mentioned they can go online and pay. They're mobile adaptive. We have chat functions. And everybody goes, whoa, nobody ever asks, well, what are your results? And, you know, how does that work for people under 30? And and most of my people are of this age, and what are you doing about that? I've literally never had that conversation with a client, even though I know going in what to expect from their demographic.
Okay, interesting. There are a few questions that have come in, and we're getting relatively close to the top of the hour. So before we wrap up, let me see if I can get to some of these. If you have a question, now would be the perfect time to type it into your Zoom webinar control panel and send it our way, and we'll try and get to as many of these as we can. Here's one for Sophie. Sophie mentioned communication by debt type. Would you be so kind as to expand on that, and give a few examples? For example, do student loan debts warrant more text email communications as opposed to telephone calls?
This is a great question. So communication by debt type, what we find the debt type is going to be the most influential for isn't necessarily the channel, so text versus email versus phone versus social media, but more of the content of the communication. So we have 300 plus emails in our system, and so a lot of times when I'm saying communication by debt type, it's going to be helping us to divide that giant chunk of emails into what's going to work for this consumer. That being said, we do find that for example, student loans, usually we want to have a phone call with them or some type of interaction, but that's completing multiple different features, which is really important to understand that debt type and debt amount are sometimes linked. And it's really important to know which is the feature and which is, you know, just an additional thing that gets added.
So there are 300 different emails that are possible emails that someone can get. Is that what that means?
Yes, more than 300 at this point. And so a lot of what our system is doing is figuring out how to send the right email to the right person at the right time. And that's a combination of compliance, heuristics, and machine learning.
Wow. Here's a question. Do any of the panels send surveys to customers to gauge the most efficient digital channels to pursue?
I'm happy to take the first whack at this one. So we do send periodic surveys to kind of understand what channels we might want to reach into. And then every time we launch a new channel, we do it in a proof of concept experiment, where usually we just start by giving customers the option of opting into that channel. And then we see what reactions look like. Do we get any complaints based on keywords, things like that. And after that stage, we decide if we want to actually invest in it. Push notifications is an example of this. We found that we actually had really similar opt-in rates to traditional e-commerce websites, which is a pretty good indicator that it's a channel we're going to be pursuing in the new future as a real strategy.
We have not done surveys. We did track complaints for a period of time on people who wanted to be able to communicate with us via email or something like that. And the number of people who complained about it and raised it as an option was really less than 2% of all the people who pay. So we didn't think the liability trade-off was there for us yet.
Yeah, we do not.
Okay. What this is one for Brian. What portion of payments occur without speaking to your consumers over the phone?
Oh, it's less than 3%. As far as web-based payments, well, let me see. Let me think about that again. If we're talking about just first-time web-based payments, the total number of payments that come in is about 3% of our total payments are web-based. Now, that doesn't include people who just send in money through the first letter or something like that. So if we're talking technology, it's not a big number yet. And then the number of payments that come in off of the first letter without anybody talking to them or another notice or subsequent to that, it's that I don't have an exact number for. But I do know the web-based payments, about 3%.
Excellent.
And our website allows payment in full as well as setting up a payment plan within parameters. So it's not, you know, full balance or nothing. So they have the option of doing an ACH directly there and so on.
I think this is another one for you, Brian, going back to what you're talking about with caller ID. The question is, how do you get your company name ID to show up on a cell phone?
Yeah, because Southern Oregon Credit Service, Inc. is more than 14 characters, isn't it? So we tackled that by registering SOCS, Inc. as an assumed business name. And so that is what shows up in the caller ID window, and that's registered with Secretary of State. So if you go to the Secretary of State's website, SOCS, Inc., you will get our company. So we don't have that deception problem. And then we have the main hunt group number for our collectors is the one that shows up there. So when they call back, they're going to call directly into the collection department. And if they were to Google SOCS Inc., they should get us. They'll probably get a bunch of other stuff as well. But legally, we're cool there. So that was really the trick. If I couldn't put my name or some facsimile of the name in there, I probably would leave it blank, as opposed to trying to truncate it at 14 characters.
Thank you. Another one for Sophie. The question is, so TrueAccord uses debt type, engagement level, and then ... what else?
So I'm not going to give you all of our features, as that would be a bad business plan. But so engagement level is a bit of an abstraction. We use every single piece of data that we collect after how a customer is interacting with our system. So did they open our email? What did they interact with on our website? What interaction did they have on the phone? And we're constantly trying to increase the set of features we have available. And sometimes we enhance them using machine learning as well. So for example, we just introduced something called automatic inbound triaging. So when customers email us, they go through a machine learning algorithm now, which categorizes them into contact type. This saves our agents hours a day of trying to categorize these and allows them to respond much faster and more targeted. But it also gives us really good insights into why customers are interacting with us. And that can be a really powerful feature, not just for our collection strategy, but in terms of how we enhance our collection strategy, where we need to focus on, what type of content we need to add, things like that.
Very excellent. Thank you. One more for you, Sophie. Have you explored non-traditional payment methods, pay with credit card points, gamification, et cetera, at all, in addition to non-traditional contact methods?
We definitely have, especially for customers who are in what we call preventative hardship right now. That's still in a testing phase. We're trying to figure out how this might work in a long-term strategy, but we are seeing some success. It's definitely something that our consumers are looking for. We just need to figure out how to provide it.
Okay, thank you. We're getting pretty close to the top of the hour, and what I'd like to do is give each of the panelists a chance. Mike, we'll start with you. Based on what you've heard, based on your experience, based on what your view of where the industry is going, can you give any insights or share any ideas about how you'd like to further tailor your collection strategy based on either generational or any other way that you can segment your portfolios or the debtors you're contacting?
No, absolutely. It kind of, we hit on earlier. One of the things that I'd like to do for myself as well as our organization, is to actually break down our inventory based off of the generational gaps to determine, what are we seeing in terms of liquidation from each generation? What work plans can we possibly modify based on the generation to determine a better way to approach those particular segments instead of a one-size-fits-all approach? Also look at payment trends, what are we seeing in terms of, the percentage of balance in full payments compared to payment arrangements? What is the average of those payment arrangements? Those type of statistical data that's going to enable us to actually stratify our work plans a little bit better. So that's my walk away from this conversation. I'd like to be able to be more dynamic in terms of some of the other methods, whether it be app based or, message based through emails, et cetera. But there are some compliance issues that we do face with that. So that's just scary as I'll get out for that, but would love to explore that a little bit more and like to see some more opportunities for our regulators to help us in that area.
Excellent. Thanks, Brian. What about you? How would you like to see your collection strategy maybe be refined as we move on through this year and beyond?
I think that the email and the texting are, if we can get regulatory clearance to do that, that would probably be a huge boon for us. And I think that would, you want to be able to communicate in the way that the consumer wants to communicate with you. Those are two areas we would definitely see as advantageous. And I think when we can clear and feel good about the liability issues, we would move into that. It's interesting listening to Sophie talk about the collection and use of metadata and individual data on everybody that takes part in her system. Clearly her company is, in the cutting edge of the information revolution. We had the Industrial Revolution some time ago, and right now I remember sitting through a discussion on we're in the middle of the information revolution and how to use that and how to amplify it. And that's, that is the future, no question about it. The issue for me is always, how do you balance where the future is and where what still works very well, and how long is that going to work very well? So you have to have a foot in both places for us, because for me, we don't work primarily with that group as our customers. So we have to be able to be balanced, but we don't want to get left behind. I think that's probably the struggle for a lot of us, is that how do we capture some of these really powerful tools without losing, the best tools in your toolbox, without, giving up what already does work very well. So that's always the challenge, and it'll only get worse, I think, for us moving forward.
Sophie, as a company that's sort of embraced this, this challenge and is really kind of using charter technology to try and change it, how would you kind of answer that, those concerns?
Which concerns?
Just about having sort of what he's talking about having sort of a foot in both, what works now, plus sort of but being able to sort of, be proactive in terms of where the future is going.
Yeah. So our system is a multi-channel system. So while we're predominantly digitally oriented, meaning emails are our bread and butter, we do really take it as the primary importance to serve the customer. So we're thinking about what is missing from our product to miss different types of technology savviness levels, different types of debt types, different debt amounts, things like that. So we're really, really want to make sure that if somebody wants to talk to us on the phone or wants to get a letter, that we're making sure our product provides those things, both by collecting that kind of inference data from what they're doing. And we also build it out into our website where you can request a phone call if that's really what you want, or you can request a paper statement if that's really what you want. We're just trying to embrace the idea that debt collection is an emotional thing for a lot of people, and it should be as easy as possible. So if you want to be treated in a specific way, you should really just be able to tell us what that is.
Excellent. I appreciate that. And with that, we've kind of reached the top of the hour. And before I let everybody go, I want to thank Sophie, Mike, and Brian for their insights and their time today. I really appreciate them giving some very thoughtful and insightful answers and sharing some of what works and what doesn't work within their respective organizations. So this webinar definitely would not have been possible without their participation. I also want to thank MicroBuilt one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.microbuilt.com to learn more about the company. And thank you to everybody for participating today. Thank you to those who signed up, who listened, who asked questions. Really appreciate your support. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. And I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.